This is Jim Inkster coming today on the show. We will revisit the George Zimmerman acquittal and the death of Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida. Our guests include Mike Wolf, veteran attorney in Baton Rouge, and Cleveland Kuhn, professor of law at Southern University. We'll talk with the legal minds about the aftermath of one of the most celebrated trials in modern times. Much attention still going on regarding what happened in Florida with a not guilty verdict for George Zimmerman. Also, Andy Anderson, the well-known financial analyst here in Baton Rouge, on the bull market and whether it will continue as the Dow Jones Industrial Average pushes to new heights. All this, but now we pause for just a while on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and thanks for your support for WRKF and the Food Bank of Baton Rouge. And with us to talk this segment is Andy Anderson, the well-known financial analyst who's been with us for several years off and on, talking about what's happening on Wall Street and beyond. Good morning to you, BF Andy Anderson.
Good morning, Jim. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average is spiraling to new heights, right at 15,500. Can it continue?
Well, I'll say this. We're having one of the best years as a growth stock manager. We're having one of the best years we've had in quite a while. The trend is up, and that's part of the research that we do. We do a lot of trend analysis of several indices, and I would say right now the most encouraging news is that the strongest sector of the market is the small-cap stocks and the mid-cap stocks and the NASDAQ. So we're starting to see confidence coming into the system where people are willing to start to believe in the future again. For the last several years, the leading indices have always been things like dividend-paying stocks, utility stocks, bank stocks, stocks of what I refer to as stocks of the past.
Right.
And it's just really encouraging to see the market really starting to firm up, and we're starting to see more entrepreneurial activity that we desperately need in this country.
You're constantly diversifying your portfolio. We've had you on this show many times, and for years you were bullish, I mean big bullish, on Apple. You got rid of Apple at one point. It's now at 427, down from 705 about a year ago. It went down to about 380. So has Apple hit its bottom, or is it going to come back up?
Well, as I mentioned last time we were here, that since 1880, we have had 27 bull markets. Every single bull market is led by new inventions, new technologies, new things. Now, Apple, as I have said in the past, my greatest concern was Steve Jobs' health. And it really was frustrating that he went a holistic route to try to cure his cancer versus more of a traditional cure, because there are a lot of people that are of the opinion that he would still be with us today. Well, if Steve Jobs was still with us today, he would probably be buying a company called Tesla.
He wouldn't be buying Apple?
I think you've got to think about Apple as a migration. They started out in 2003 with the iPod. That's when we first discovered the stock, was 2003. We bought it at $30 a share. Now, we sold it last year for $660. Now, the iPod, which was iTunes, was just the tip of the iceberg. So when you started to see the migration here, no one knew that they were going to come out with an iPhone. So with the iPod, they revolutionized the music industry. Then they come along with the iPhone, totally revolutionized the telecommunication industry. So for them to be able to move the needle, they've got to come up with something really big. It's got to be big. And there's a lot of talk about a television set and all that, but I really think they've got to either come up with something in-house or they need to make a major acquisition.
All right, and people say, why do you talk so much about Apple? It still is the most widely held stock in the world by a pretty good margin. But what is it about Tesla that you like?
It's the entrepreneur that is running this company, a guy named Elon Musk. You got to realize this guy came out of Pretoria, South Africa. Mm-hmm. He was being drafted into the apartheid army. He didn't want anything to do with it. Moved to Canada, became a citizen of Canada. His mother was a citizen of Canada. Ended up being recruited by Stanford University to get his PhD in physics. He went for 2 days and wrote the dean a letter saying that he had a business opportunity, that he had to take a break from school, and he went and founded PayPal and made $1 billion. And so this guy is what you call a serial entrepreneur. This is what you're looking for. You're looking for that individual that has been trying not to sound too religious here, but has been touched by some upper power that it's just so hard to explain. But all these great investments that if you think about over our lifetime, it's been John D. Rockefeller, it's been Thomas Edison, it's been Stephen Jobs, it's been Bill Gates, it's been Sam Walton. There's no coincidence here. There, you look for the serial entrepreneur, and Elon Musk, the CEO of Tesla, is certainly a serial entrepreneur.
Right. Well, in the first hour of trading today, for what it's worth, Tesla is down 5 points
right.
to 122.
Yeah, Goldman Sachs came out with a report.
Must not have been a good report.
No, here's another point. The other point is, too, you want to look for things that are incalculatable. You don't want, you know, you get into these situations with investing where everybody has to calculate, you know, that it's undervalued or it pays this much in dividend. When you get involved in something like the iPod, and it's incalculable where this is going to go, well, that's where you make the big money in the market. So what's happening with Goldman this morning, they're trying to put some kind of calculation together saying that the stock's only worth, you know, $80 or something like that. Look, it's just their opinion. That's all it is. It's just opinion.
Well, in the last several years, going back to 1993, 20 years, the years Democrats have been in the White House, I guess 13 of those 20 years, market's gone up.
Yeah.
In the 8 years that George Bush was in, the market cratered.
It's terrible.
So based on that, if a Democratic president is in office, should I invest? And if a Republican president is in office, should I go to the sidelines?
You know, I think investing is a way of life. It's just something that you do your entire life. My father started buying stocks in 1933, and he held his stocks until the day he died. He never sold a share. You know, it's just a way of life thing. It's something that I've been taught by my parents and my grandfather, that you just don't jump in and jump out. But to answer your question about this, I think it's important. Wars are the worst thing that happens to the stock market because it's just so counterproductive. It depletes us of our young men. It distracts everything, and it's just not a good thing. So it seems like we have more under the Bush administration. We certainly had a lot of wars. But the other thing I'm a big believer in, and this is something that's hard to understand, but you know, the top 1% needs to understand that they need customers.
Mm-hmm.
And Sam Walton was brilliant at this in Walmart because he would, like, give diapers away below cost just to get traffic into the stores. Well, that's famous economist, his name is slipping me, but famous economist came up with a concept called velocity of money. And so when you have more people doing better, I mean, meaning the middle class and even, you know, whatever, more people are getting, it's not the top 1%. They're getting money.
All right,
you increase Democrats have a tendency to increase the velocity of money.
Okay. Yeah, the market has done very well under Clinton and Obama, exceptionally well, as it did well also under Reagan and the first President Bush, but it did horribly under the second President Bush, and Andy Anderson says war is the biggest reason why.
Oh, it's horrible.
What about interest rates? It looks like the Fed may not keep rates at the levels they are, and if that happens, they're going to have inflation. We could have some issues in the market, couldn't we?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up. There's, in my opinion, there are only two factors that drive stock and bond prices. And the first one would be interest rates. Okay, if interest rates are going lower, and they have been. Now, realize several years ago, Moody's and Standard & Poor's cut the rating on the U.S. government bond for the first time in 200 years. And so what happened was there was a flight to safety, which means that everybody ran to gold, everybody ran to bonds, everybody ran to dividend-paying stocks, and have driven interest rates down 80, 90%. I mean, we're looking at 0% interest rates, basically. So I think that part of the equation is over. So for this market to move higher, one thing has to happen, and that's the second component, earnings. If corporations do not deliver earnings, and I think also more than that, they're going to have to start delivering top-line revenues. Without that, this market goes no higher. But I think that's starting to happen. And so far, this earnings season has been pretty darn good.
Well, Andy Anderson, we thank you for joining us, and we'll have a longer visit next time, I'm sure. Maybe we'll be joined by your sidekick, Iyad Esbahi. Iyad's report shows that his investments are up for his clients marginally, like 2 or 3% this year, maybe a little more than that. But how are you doing for 2013?
We're having the best year we've had. We're up 26% as of yesterday.
Not the best year ever, right?
No, not best year ever. Our best year ever, we were up 140%, which was back in 1999.
And you've had ups and downs.
But, yeah, sure.
But 26%, that's
it's a good year.
Well, so far, so good.
Well, we've more than doubled our money in Tesla, which has been a real big winner for us.
And you're sticking with Tesla.
I think so.
All right. Well, we'll be back after this short pause on WRKF to talk about the George Zimmerman verdict. Do want to note that today would have been the 85th birthday of David Connor Treen, Louisiana governor, 1980 to 84, born in Baton Rouge on this date in 1928. David Treen, back after this pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Our guests are attorney Mike Wolf, who's been practicing law in Baton Rouge for, about over 30 years now, right?
40 now.
40 years. And Cleveland Kuhn, professor of law at Southern University. Professor Kuhn has been teaching on the bluff for 24 years, and they're here to talk about the verdict in Florida, Sanford, Florida, Saturday night. George Zimmerman found not guilty of killing Trayvon Martin. And, of course, the backlash has been quite evident around the country and in this community. Many people are voicing their thoughts about the verdict in Florida. Mike Wolf, what did you think of the jury's decision?
I thought it was very reasonable, it seems, under the circumstances. I watched a lot of the trial testimony. And it was quite clear that the state did not prove a murder. It appeared to be a case in which the charge was excessive. They call it overcharging, and many people have made that observation.
You thought it was an appropriate verdict?
Yes, very much. Yeah, they did not prove murder, and they didn't prove manslaughter beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a fairly easy decision to make from a legal point of view.
Professor Kuhn, what do you think?
Gosh, growing up in the South, I guess my opinion has to be tainted by personal experiences and other observations. Perhaps the most appropriate answer to say is that I agree with Mr. Wolf that obviously the state did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt or meet its burden of proof regarding the charge of murder or even manslaughter. However, you have to question, I guess, tactics that were used by the state in the manner in which they put on their evidence. And I think a very key ruling was the disallowance of the voice analysis, that expert testimony. I think that was perhaps the biggest blow to the state's case.
Who was shouting right before the fatal shot? Do we
know? Exactly.
Who do you think, Professor Kuhn?
I can only say that given the disparity in the sizes of the two individuals, that my guess would be that it was the young man who was doing the screaming.
Trayvon?
Yes. I also am aware of the analysis that was done prior to the trial. And while they could not identify Trayvon Martin's voice, they could rule out, and did rule out, that it was George Zimmerman's voice, because they did have a sample of his voice. And so I thought on that basis, the state, or at least the court, could have allowed evidence that it was not George Zimmerman's voice, although there was no indication that it was Trayvon Martin's voice. Mm-hmm. However, there were only two individuals there, and certainly if you exclude one, I think that's sufficient evidence for the jury to conclude that it was Trayvon Martin's voice and not George Zimmerman.
297-5633, if you'd like to join our conversation with Professor Cleveland Kuhn, Southern University, and lawyer Mike Wolf. Mike, George Zimmerman did not take the stand. Does that mean anything?
It does as a matter of practice. Of course, legally, our system insists that one is not to be prejudiced for not testifying, that he has the right to be silent, and that all courts order the juries not to hold that against them. But as a realistic matter, I think most jurors are skeptical when the person doesn't, and I think it's just human nature. But apparently, in this case, the doubt was so very clear as to whether Zimmerman had murdered Martin that there was no need for him to take the stand to convince the jury that the case had not been proven.
Mm-hmm. There were no blacks on the jury. Professor Kuhn, is that unfortunate?
Gosh, I hate to think that we live in a society where we need one or two or half of the jury composed of African Americans or of the same race as the defendant in order to achieve justice. I don't know whether that was a factor in the decision of the jury. I just don't want to venture that. Six females, certainly, I'm sure at least one or two were mothers and could very well relate to the anguish and the sorrow and sadness of the victim's family. So I don't want to say that race of the jury, the makeup of the jury, the racial makeup of the jury was a factor. No, I'm not going to say that.
Bruce and Walden. Bruce, you're on the air with Professor Cleveland Kuhn and lawyer Mike Wolf.
Okay, thanks a lot. Yeah, the jurors have broken their silence, as the saying goes, and one of them is saying that the judge's instructions to the jury tied their hands, that they saw that they had no option but to provide a not guilty verdict. So I was wondering if you two folks familiar with the law might comment on the judge's instructions.
You'd like me to go with that?
Yeah.
I thought the instructions were the traditional instructions for murder charges, and I did hear them. I think they were appropriate. The key one was on self-defense, and it's pretty general in this country that one is entitled to use deadly force if he reasonably believes that his life is in danger or he's in danger of serious injury and can only use deadly force, such as using a pistol he has on him, to defend himself. And I think that law is pretty much the same in every state. She pointed that out. And because of the burden of proof that the state has, they had to negative self-defense. That means they had to prove that it was not self-defense. And with that burden, all doubts are reserved against the party with the burden of proof. So since there were obvious doubts, the state had to lose.
Professor Kuhn?
Well, I'm sure, and I didn't listen to the jury instructions. I'm sure those were standard jury instructions that would be given in any trial of this nature. However, I do question how one can provoke an incident and then call it self-defense when either the tables may have turned on them. I thought that was key to show George Zimmerman's state of mind before even the contact with Trayvon Martin may very well have shown his intent to perhaps provoke a confrontation. This business about they always get away, but not this time or not with me, that seems to show a state of mind that he had no intentions of retreating from that incident. And certainly I thought the state perhaps could have dwelled on that a bit more. That's just me, of course, and I don't want to second-guess their strategy. Perhaps I'm doing that now, but I thought his state of mind showed perhaps an intention to confront this young man.
Quelly in Scotlandville. Hi, Quelly. You're on with Mike in Cleveland.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you? I just want to say that there were many commentary that was made about Mr. Zimmerman after the trial. One of the supporters outside the courtroom even called him a patriot. One of the jurors even said that she would love to have him as her neighborhood watch. My question is, as part of Zimmerman's job as a neighborhood watch, it was also his job to make sure that Trayvon Martin made it home safely. In this case, we evidently know that he didn't do his job as a neighborhood watch. And my other question is,
All right, that's one question. What about the one juror did make the statement that George Zimmerman would be welcome to be a neighborhood watch person in her neighborhood? That seems like a preposterous statement, considering Mr. Zimmerman failed miserably in the task in Sanford, Florida.
Well, that was in the context of an interview by Anderson Cooper last night, and he was trying very hard to get that juror to dump on George Zimmerman. He wanted her to criticize him and to say he was an unsuitable person for such things. I think it was a forced remark, but really, I don't think it's outrageous. No, it's really just irrelevant. Why are we talking about that? I'm sure he'll never do it again. Her ultimate comment was, after what he just went through, she thought he'd be the most cautious neighborhood watchman in the country.
All right. Well, there is a letter to the editor today from a gentleman in Cranston, Rhode Island. This is in the New York Times. He writes, "The racial dimensions of the Trayvon Martin case have been explored at length. What is rarely mentioned is what is most obvious about this tragic incident. George Zimmerman was walking around a common area, not his own personal property, with a loaded handgun when he confronted Mr. Martin. This is legal in Florida. A citizen on patrol should be armed with a cell phone and nothing more. Had this been the case, Mr. Martin would be alive. End of story." Dr. Kuhn, what do you think?
I have to agree with that. I really have to agree with that. It's not so much, I think it's a commentary on attitudes of individuals towards each other. And here he presumed that this young man was doing something wrong, and therefore he has to go confront him, as opposed to walking up to him and saying, "Hello, my name is George Zimmerman. I'm with the Neighborhood Watch. Do you have a problem, or is there anything I can help you with?" No, his immediate thought was, he's doing something wrong. He looks like he's up to something. And I think therein lies the problem this whole affair, and it's a sad commentary on the presumption of innocence. He's a civilian. He has a handgun. He failed at least one test to become a police officer. Was unsuitable. I don't know for what reasons, but I don't know that as a part of Neighborhood Watch, he needed a handgun to do his job.
All right, David in Lafayette. David, you're on with Michael Wolf and Cleveland Kuhn.
Yes, good morning. Real quick, and maybe you all have covered this already, but how is it that you can initiate a confrontation with someone and be found innocent? Basically kill someone because you initiated the confrontation and you're found innocent.
All right.
The problem is, I think we have a major problem in reasoning and in people's ability to analyze this case objectively. Professor Kuhn just spoke about the presumption of innocence that should have been accorded to Trayvon Martin, and I agree with most of his comments. But that presumption should be accorded to Mr. Zimmerman as well. And you can't trace back every cause of an event and say that wherever there was a piece of causation, that resulted in criminal responsibility. Yes, it's true, the incident wouldn't have happened if he had not gotten out of his car, if he had not been on the Neighborhood Watch Committee, if he had not gone up to the man. And it's surely he was rash and did probably presume guilt where he shouldn't have, or he was over-suspicious. But the law anticipates that by saying it's not criminal to be snoopy, it's not criminal to be nosy or to be suspicious or even to be bigoted, but you have to reduce things down to the point of violence and say that's what has to be prevented. And when the apparently the younger man, who was taller and more agile and more capable physically, it seems clear, jumped on Zimmerman and was beating him into the concrete. When that sort of thing happens, he's entitled to use self-defense. And so you can't just stop it by saying he was unreasonably suspicious of him.
All right. Professor Kuhn, you may see it differently.
Well, I agree with Mr. Wolf. And from the standpoint of using self-defense, it could easily turn out that once a person initiates the aggressive act, he is no longer a danger.
Paula in Shenandoah, please be brief. Paula, you're on with Professor Cleveland Kuhn and Mike Wolf.
Good morning, gentlemen. I actually had the pleasure of studying under Professor Kuhn last summer at Southern. It's been interesting to me the comparison of the laws, because I think in Louisiana the outcome would have been different, because it's my understanding in Louisiana that the aggressor cannot claim self-defense unless you have clearly stood down. My idea about this is that Mr. Martin was the one who felt threatened and was reacting. Do you gentlemen think that the outcome would have been different under Louisiana law?
No, it wouldn't. And it's true, we have a provision, and I'm sure Florida does too, that an aggressor cannot claim self-defense. An aggressor must withdraw. But that means somebody who is aggressing with violence, who is attacking somebody and causing him to be entitled to use self-defense and possibly escalate the encounter.
Professor Kuhn, briefly.
Well, I think you can meet aggression with like force. And here this young man was unarmed. Obviously, George Zimmerman had a firearm.
All right. We're going to take a short break, and we will return for another segment with Mike Wolf and Cleveland Kuhn after this brief pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher producing. And in our final segment, we once again have Professor Cleveland Kuhn of Southern University's Law Center and Mike Wolf, 40 years practicing law in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 if you'd like to join us by telephone on the show. We're talking about the acquittal of George Zimmerman and the slaying of Trayvon Martin. There are those in the legal community, great legal minds such as Alan Dershowitz, Mike Wolf, who say this case never should have been prosecuted, that it was clear that in his mind that Zimmerman was an innocent man. Do you share that point of view?
More or less. Actually, I wouldn't be certain of Zimmerman's state of mind, but I don't think the case should have been brought. I think it as a murder charge. It appears the investigation showed the man was apparently trying to defend himself, and apparently it was the pressure of basically the demonstrations and the public uproar that caused the state to decide to charge him without even taking the case to a grand jury. They overruled the usual prosecution procedures to bring this case as a more serious matter than it was. And by the way, I think the whole shebang has hurt the rule of law in this country by leading people to believe that you don't have to think and analyze, that you can simply decide whether you like a person or not, and thereby decide whether he should be guilty of a crime.
All right, Professor Kuhn, what are your thoughts?
Exactly, I agree with that wholeheartedly. That last statement, that the impact that this has on the rule of law. And it's certainly, I don't like sagging pants and hoodies or anything else for the most part, but I do know that young man or any person has the right to dress the way they want to dress and not to have a presumption of guilt associated with them because of the way they dress or because they're in the wrong neighborhood or because they don't fit in a particular neighborhood. And I think that's what this does. And I think this situation, as well as other stand your ground laws around the country, create this presumption of guilt, and it's much easier to use deadly force and provide an explanation later. The case should have been tried. Perhaps it should have gone to the grand jury, but there should have been some charge that grew out of this situation, because there are only two people who know what happened. That's Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman. And I think from a factual reconstruction, you could perhaps come to a conclusion as to whether there should have been criminal charges filed against George Zimmerman as a result of what happened, as best it could be determined.
All right. Wade at Louis writes, this appears to be a strong example of the need to restrict the ownership of guns. Remove the gun from the incident, and all you have is a fist fight. Maybe without the gun, Zimmerman would have stayed in his car. Professor Kuhn?
Well, again, I'm an advocate of the right to keep and bear arms. I do have a problem with the manner in which it has become so easy to gain access to a firearm. And in this case, obviously, if Mr. Zimmerman had not been born, going back to Mr. Wolf's statement on causation, none of this would have ever happened. But the fact of the matter is, he did have a firearm. I don't know that he needed a firearm as a neighborhood watchman. That is for the police department. And all he needed was a cell phone to call 911 if he thought some criminal activity was taking place. Again, he could have introduced himself. I'm George Zimmerman. Is there anything I can help you with? Are you lost, or do you live here? Any number of those questions would have disarmed the situation. But to walk into a situation and say, these assholes always get away, or he looks like he's up to something, that shows a state of mind where he's not interested in who this young man is or what house he may have come from. All he's thinking is that this kid is up to criminal activity, and that's the problem I have.
John in New Roads says, should we switch to a system of college-educated, licensed professional jurors? Mike Wolf.
Well, that's interesting. That would not be jurors of the peers of the defendants. but the problem of
is that a no?
Yeah. Of racing to yes, of course you can't do that. You got to have the possibility for anyone in the community to serve on the jury. But the problem of making too many presumptions and of rush to judgment can't be overlooked in this case. I sympathize with what the professor is saying. Certainly, it would have been better if Zimmerman didn't have the pistol, if he didn't have the suspicions, if there hadn't been so many crimes in the neighborhood lately and so forth. But what justified Trayvon Martin in jumping on him and beating him up?
Do we know that's what happened?
It apparently that's what happened, and certainly when you're deciding whether the case has been proven, it appears that was not disproved. It appeared that it happened. Everybody saw his bloody head and so forth, and that apparently
and
is what
the
happened.
The injuries were not very extreme to Mr. Zimmerman.
The famous forensic experts spoke of the concussions and other injuries one could suffer with that kind of damage.
Could
yes, couldn't. You don't know, but you don't know at all. If someone's knocking your head into the sidewalk, you're going to fear serious injury. And you'll be dazed anyway, and your judgment won't be the best. I can assure you
one arm was free, Mike. He was able to shoot a man.
Yeah.
He wasn't pinned to the ground, or he wouldn't have had an arm free to shoot.
Yes, but this guy was a pudgy, incapable fighter. But
he wasn't that pudgy then. He got pudgy in the last year.
Anyway, the thing is, we have to look at the violence. The violence was started by Trayvon
and
Martin,
some,
apparently.
By the way, some pudgy people who can fight.
And we've got to address that. And it's too bad when people say, oh, this was guns. Because he had a gun, he was responsible. Because he was over-suspicious, he was responsible. Because he started the encounter in the sense of following Mr. Martin. But you have to look at the cause of the violence. Where did the violence start? And you can't go back, like the professor said, to his birth. You could blame all this on their parents for having them. There's no end to it.
Right.
We have to have a legal system where we look at the last area, the last chance where you have an attempt to control violence, which is at the point where...
Okay, Rinaldi and Sherwood. Rinaldi, you're on with Professor Kuhn and Mike Wolf. Hi, Rinaldi.
Good morning. Just a quick point. Everybody's talking about the stand your ground law and all that, and I understand all of those things, okay? But here's a simple point, okay? What's being lost in this whole thing? Number one, race is, in fact, an issue in this, and we want to duck this in this country. We don't want to have the spine to deal with. And then number two, let's take the stand your ground law. What about Trayvon Martin's right to stand his ground from having somebody come up behind you and stalking you and asking you questions? This is America, and you know what? We're talking about all this constitution and rule of law. What about the right for a person to walk where they want to walk, do what they want to do, go where they want to go, without somebody coming up behind you? Now, I guarantee you, I'm a 6'1", almost 300-pound black man. If I walk behind a white female, okay, and she turns around and shoots me, but she doesn't belong in my neighborhood, who the hell do you think is going to go to jail? So we need to stop glossing over this stuff. Race is, in fact, an issue. If I, as a person, were to walk behind a white male and done the same thing to him, okay, there would be no question about this. So, unfortunately, Jim, we refuse to open up the wound of race in this country and talk about it and deal with this stuff. And we can talk about the rule of law all we want. The fact of the matter is, what about Trayvon Martin's right to stand his ground. Some of these people refuse to deal with that point. And I don't hear any of your comments talking about Trayvon Martin's right to stand his ground.
All right. Thank you, Rinaldi. Professor Kuhn, what about Trayvon Martin's rights?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, he's from a younger generation. And I don't know if he had the benefit of the sage advice of his parents, or maybe he ignored the advice of his parents. When you are confronted with a situation like that, you get away from it. Now, he certainly has a right to be left alone, and that did not take place here. But, you know, you grow up in the South, and race relations being what they are, there's just certain things you do to minimize confrontation with the police, to minimize confrontation with adults, to just minimize confrontation.
No? All right, we got to roll, but thank you, Professor Kuhn, and thank you, Mike Wolf. And we will revisit this topic one more time tomorrow, so hope you'll be with us then. Until then, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening to WRKF. Thanks for your support, and stay tuned.